on December 18th for one night only. Come see formerly on hiatus Vancouver band SSRIs reunite live at the Wise Hall. The lineup will feature the membership of the 2010 LP Effeminate Godzilla-sized Wind Chimes. Don't go see Star Wars, come see SSRI's reunion show. Guest bands include TV Ugly, Blessed, and Redrick Sultan. Tickets are $10. Check out the SSRIs on Facebook for more information. This is one night only, so don't miss out. On Tuesday, December 22nd, don't miss indie rockers Pity Sex at the Cobalt on tour supporting their upcoming release, White Hot Moon, with special guests Colleen Green and Eskimo. Doors open at 8 and the 19 plus show starts at 9. Find your tickets today at timberconcerts.com or at Red Cat or Zulu.
Welcome to Transition State.
Sun don't shine.
moss across my skin, the palm trees swaying in the wind, images. You sang me Spanish lullabies, the sweetest sadness in your eyes, clever trick.
Romance. We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out The Real Deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Tune in to African Rhythms every Friday from 7:30 to 9 o'clock with your host, David Love Jones, as he plays a heavyweight selection of classics, past, present, and future. This includes jazz, soul, hip-hop, Afro-Latin, funk, and eclectic Brazilian rhythms.
Lots of people, they take it like a game.
All right, radio fans, welcome to Transition State on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We just heard some pretty good music. That was Elton John from his 1984 album Breaking Hearts. That was Sad Songs Say So Much. And before that, we heard from A Fine Frenzy. The title was Almost Lover. And before that, we heard from Beck from album Sea Change, The Golden Age. There's a bit of a theme in there, and I'd like to get into it, but I have a really exciting interview that I want to get straight to, and I don't have a lot of time this week. So earlier this week, I sat down with Dr. Peter Lowen and talked about the nature of what passes for evidence in modern pharmaceutical practice. Oh, by the way, this is the show dedicated to raising pharmaceutical awareness in the community, if you didn't already know that. But anyway, I sat down with Dr. Lowen and we had a good discussion, so I'm going to play that for you right now on CITR 101.9. Enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Like surveyors or astronomers probably have a hierarchy of instruments that that are in terms of their usefulness at identifying the hydrogen composition of distant bodies.
So astronomers...
A Hubble telescope is at the top of the levels, and my iPhone camera is at the bottom of it.
Okay.
And the instruments have different abilities to resolve that. This is analogous.
Yeah, so astronomers...
Is that arbitrary that the Hubble telescope would be the most useful instrument and your Bushnell...
There's always... Yeah, okay, but
okay,
astronomers...
Okay, Adam.
Yes.
Adam.
Yes.
If what you're going to do is just kind of shrug and go...
No, I'm about to make my point.
I'm nihilistic. I don't really know whether the Hubble telescope is any better. Then there's really nothing for us to debate.
Okay, I'm going
to
do that. But astronomers, they're not really interested in the whole everything and everything. They're interested in kind of like looking at the sky, the stuff, at least less than everything. There's stuff that's... Like, say the Hubble telescope is top for them... It's low for people who want to write a book, say, the other parts of life, right? So they kind of have a bias inherent in that. And so do you think that like medical scientists, if they're only looking at the best tools to kind of prove their clinical trials, is there an inherent bias in that?
Okay.
They're willing to discount personal experience, which in the world I think means a lot to most people. I bet they'd put that a lot ahead of some numbers that are published that have no meaning to them at all.
Okay. What you just did there is the most incredible thing ever.
Okay, because, shortly though, I really want to move on.
Okay, but I think you just revealed a worldview there.
Yeah.
That is completely anathema to the idea of science.
It's the enemy of science.
Yeah.
Poison for science.
The worldview you just revealed there is I'm going to say it, I think it's true. It's anti-science. What you just said there, and if this is your worldview, I feel like I should say this with love,
okay,
but be deliberate. You should not be in the healthcare field, because what you just said there, mm-hmm, sounded like, and I'm not offended by it,
okay,
by the way, but if it clicked in my mind that many of the things you've expressed, it makes sense if you believe what you just said. You just talked about the idea that scientists are biased towards finding their results to be true or something, which, and then doesn't people's personal experience count for more than that, or doesn't, yeah. So.
Well, there are others who would disagree. Mm-hmm. That's why I kind of meant that the hierarchy is arbitrary, because some people would just say the opposite.
So, many arguments dissolve into just arguing about definitions of words.
Okay.
So I'm going to call you on this and say, if you're going to use the word arbitrary, you better explain to me what arbitrary means.
Oh dear, which I can't do. Let me just wrap that, because all I meant, do you not think there's any bias inherent in that? The people who work with clinical trials happen to conclude that clinical trials are the most, like, kind of. It seems like they kind of have blinders on to anything else, and that's why they think this is the most important.
Do you think that bacteria cause diseases?
They do. I'm pretty convinced, yeah. Personal experience, mechanism of action, clinical evidence.
Okay, so
convincing. That's
without
convincing.
People using science to understand that relationship, we would literally all be still dying of bubonic plague. When the plague was destroying the world, it was pre the understanding that bacteria caused disease.
Okay.
So, your earlier statement that I was
highlighting. Wasn't it penicillin in the sandwich he left out, though?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was like a personal experience and he found it like, oh, or this is penicillin.
Yeah, you observe something in the universe. So seeing that your mold from your bread fell in your petri dish and bacteria seemed to die, that's an observation in the universe, right?
Yeah, and you also have the microscope and stuff. There's no statistics,
yeah.
No clinical trials.
Right, you think that's how penicillin got to the market? Huh?
No, yeah, I
there was
I know
around
vaccines
1,000 steps of actual science that followed that. What?
Okay.
What?
Well, definition of science.
Story
I'll ask you what.
No, you have to do experiments and you replicate the observation under. You ready for this?
Yep.
Controlled conditions.
Done. Yep. I'll give you that.
That's what cohort studies and case control studies and RCTs are. They're about controlling the conditions. Anyway,
okay.
Move on, but
okay. This is connected, but I think it might allow us to move on. So, you have if anybody who has a heart attack, myocardial infarction, will be prescribed certain kind of amount medications: ACE inhibitor, blood pressure lowering, and statin.
And antiplatelet.
Antiplatelet, but and statins. So the blood pressure lowering. Makes sense to me, because you're like, reducing load on your heart. The beta blocker makes sense to me. The statin anti-lipid makes no sense. And I do see the numbers at the trials, and it's not just one trial, and it starts to add up, and I'm really, honestly, I feel like I'm convinced that statins do, I would say, correlate with living longer lives, having fewer heart attacks. But does that not pain you at all to, like, know that something happens, but not know why? Taking that mechanism out to dispense a drug, having no idea how it works, just trusting that it works, is that like a red flag?
So many things.
Okay, if that's the case,
there's so many questions.
Could we not have a high school? Why do you need a pharmacist then? All you need is somebody to, high school students to read the results of studies. Don't you need a pharmacist to understand the drugs and understand?
You need a pharmacist to help to figure out how to intervene to help an individual person who has a health need. You need a pharmacist for, among many things, to figure out whether and how the results of that trial, to use an example of a simple case where there's a drug and a trial,
mm-hmm.
how those results apply to the individual who has a need. So,
I think
what are their values and preferences? What are they the kind of person who the results apply to? Do they have is their diagnosis relevant in terms of that evidence? Do they have the means to essentially buy the intervention? Are they able to follow through with the intervention? When we're talking about drugs, you know, how much of the therapy can they tolerate? What are they at particular risk for having an adverse effect of this therapy? Do they have a liver and or a kidney to clear this drug? Is the severity of their condition such that they're likely to benefit from it, or is their condition so mild that their probability of benefiting is extremely small? The application pharmacists provide care to individual patients. They don't provide care to trials or populations.
Okay.
This is why we need pharmacists.
Okay. You'll probably be able to answer the next question, because I was going to ask, aren't we just letting the trials do the thinking for us?
So I honestly wonder whether no, that was not. So you learn somewhere in the first year of your pharmacy education,
yeah,
that evidence-based practice has three pillars.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's arbitrary too. I mean, not four.
Okay, seven.
Okay.
Three of them are.
Let's call them three.
Add
okay.
more. I don't care. It's fine. I mean, I'm literally fine with that.
All right.
But there are three.
Okay.
Which are, it seems as though you have not recalled them, because what you just said was to say that it all depends on one.
It's reasonable.
So it has to do, the three pillars are clinical acumen. In other words, you're my patient. What's wrong with you? How severe is it? What is your complaint? What's your diagnosis? What's my assessment? What's the size of your liver? Do you have Murphy's sign? Is this your pancreas? What's your glucose doing? How's your vision? Assessing your patient.
Okay.
That is a whole body of skills that are essential to providing medical care to a person. By medical care,
mm-hmm.
the care provided by a physiotherapist, a physician, a pharmacist, or a nurse.
Yeah.
That's part of evidence-based medicine.
Yeah,
if you can't tell what's wrong with your patient, then all the evidence in the world isn't relevant.
Yeah.
Do you have cancer or heart failure? I don't know. I can't differentiate that. Therefore, you can't practice evidence-based practice. You understand?
Yeah.
The second is that you have the ability to access and appraise the best available evidence.
Okay.
And figure out, does it apply to my patient? And the third is patient values. So is it appropriate to perform this intervention in this patient based on the evidence, and given my clinical assessment of them, the evidence, and their values? No, I cannot force you to take any therapy that you are unwilling to take once you are informed of the effects, benefits, risks, not just of the therapy, but of your condition. Well, what if I don't take this? Well, actually, nothing's going to happen. Well, actually, if you just like eat less salt, your blood pressure is probably going to go down, and you're probably not going to need this ACE inhibitor. Those are the three pillars of evidence-based practice. What are the other four?
Oh, it would take me some time, but...
Does that feel arbitrary to you?
Yeah.
It does?
No.
Then how do you get on the bus? Like, honestly, like, how do
it's,
you
it's
function?
Hard. It's not easy. It's
no,
not
but
easy,
I mean,
I'll tell
you literally...
that.
I don't believe that.
But, yeah, are you sure, like, what about understanding biology and chemistry?
That's physical assessment. That's assessing your patient.
That's part of clinical acumen.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where the thinking
comes.
What
organ is dysfunctional here? How dysfunctional is it? How did this happen? What's causing this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's clinical acumen. Yeah, you keep crashing your bike into signposts every couple days. That's clinical acumen. Versus, these headaches are... I don't know, doc. What's causing my headaches? Do you repeatedly injure your head? Yes. That could have something. That's right. That's you ascertaining what's going on.
So here's what I mean. Say we take patient values and change that to a subsection of clinical acumen. Then we have two pillars. So that decision is arbitrary.
Okay.
I personally would probably put know your drugs as a whole other pillar.
But okay, no, but I'll tell you just a fact about the history of evidence-based practice.
Okay.
Is that when Archie Cochran was first... He was an obstetrician when he was first saying, like, we can't keep putting women who are pregnant in the hospital for 6 months and confining them to bed just because, based on our detailed understanding of physiology, that seems like the right way to treat them when they have, you know, preeclampsia or hypertension in pregnancy. We can't do that. We can't just, based on first principles or our understanding of physiology, prescribe these interventions.
Right.
We don't know how much harm or whether there's any benefit. Also, we don't know whether there's any additional harm being caused, and it turned out there was, VTEs, in super susceptible individuals. When you're pregnant, you're super susceptible to VTEs. So the worst thing, it turns out, you could ever do was rely on first principles of saying you need to rest.
Okay.
So he's trying to explain to the world why it's crazy to use your mechanism knowledge and your it just makes sense.
Yeah.
And your personal experience knowledge. Well, you know what? I've been looking after these pregnant women for 25 years. Don't come in here telling me that confining them to bed is hurting them. Okay?
Okay.
So he's explaining this to the world.
Yeah.
And he says, we need evidence. Guess what the first thing people said was, oh, sure. You're going to do these trials and it's going to be like cookbook medicine. Mm-hmm. You're just going to do exactly what the trial says without any regard to your patient. I'm an advocate for my patients. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to have some scientician telling me from a trial that involved people I don't even know how to look after my patients.
Okay.
So, dude, what you're saying... That was 50 years ago that this was uttered. So
the mechanism
we have to say, because it's true, know your patient, know the evidence, incorporate their values. This is not cookbook medicine.
Yeah.
If you're just looking at the evidence and imposing it on your patients, that's not evidence-based practice.
Yeah.
That's you as a pharmacist who works for the government looking at trials. That's not you providing care to your patients.
Okay, so here's where I feel like the reliance on mechanism, or like they used to, the antithesis of that is to ignore that and only go with clinical trials. And I'm just kind of trying to pull it back. I know it seems like I'm living in the past, but I'm thinking pull it back, synthesis, both.
Mm. I just, dude, like this was in your second week of your pharmacy degree. The evidence-based practice never, ever, ever, meaning even the first book that Archie Cochran wrote, which I gave you quotes from in your class that you may or may not have been in attendance at.
I'm sure I was there.
I'm sure you were too. Said, dudes, this is not cookbook medicine. To practice in an evidence-based framework, you have to do these three things. You have to be an amazing clinician. You have to have conversations with and assess and know your patient in detail. You have to know what the best available evidence that applies to the situation is. Mm-hmm. You have to sift the crappy evidence and get rid of it and not consider it. You have to be able to find it and appraise it and decide whether it's good or not and whether it applies or not. Remember what the three questions, the evidence, the clinician's guide to the evidence is, what were the results? How do they apply to my patient? And what were the results? Are they reliable? And how do they apply to my patient? And then you have to then incorporate their values, which maybe you think it's part of knowing your patient.
Mm-hmm.
It never was. And if you have taken in or invented in your own head a distorted view of what evidence-based practice is, which is blindly look at trials and write prescriptions on pads based on someone telling you a diagnosis, that was never evidence-based practice, and it is not today.
So you have an MI. They don't need to really get to know the patient, and they don't need any clinical acumen.
Who
you get a statin. It's not up for debate. It's not about knowing anybody. It's just, that's why
I'm not sure what healthcare system you're functioning in.
Okay.
I've never seen, even in the worst community pharmacy you can possibly imagine,
yeah.
Certainly never in an actual clinic or hospital-based situation where patients are receiving care, that you would prescribe a statin for someone who had no liver or who had a history of intolerance to a statin that you had not prosecuted through history and ascertained. I have never seen anyone willfully prescribe aspirin to someone with the combination of nasal polyps and asthma. I know what you're saying about we make population recommendations in the hospital. We have pre-printed orders that have check boxes for all the things you just said right on the MI orders.
Okay.
And you check, check, check. But if you do that without the context that this is a human being, which you could never do because you're literally there.
Yeah.
There's a bed and a sick person in it, and you have data, relevant data, because you built machines and hooked them up to those machines and pressed buttons to know their heart rate and their lead two on their rhythm strip and their blood pressure and their O2 sat and their respiratory rate. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Nothing about that allows the concept that this is what we do, hell or high water, regardless. Yeah, we just prescribe ACE, and my patient's blood pressure is 40 on 30. Well, whatever. This is what we do.
Statin. It's like a guideline. Myocardial statin. Mitochondrial infarction, statin.
Yeah, well, you know where that comes from? So
I think what I'm basing it on is, you know, we have assignments and cases, and it's on paper. And everybody you talk to, they don't want to, like, discuss the evidence or was the study reliable. They just see, am I statin?
That's what clinicians do. Every day, great point. Yeah, that's why guidelines exist, is because every clinician can't every day read every relevant trial. So guidelines are something clinicians screamed for better or worse. Now, they are their own kind of hurt. But they were screamed for by clinicians who wanted to apply the best available evidence to their patients, but have 47 patients every day to look after, and also don't trust their own critical appraisal skills to go around inventing their own approach to everything. Cardiologists, why don't you guys get together and give me a transparent, thoughtful, tell me what you looked at, how you decided what you decided. I'll read that, and if I agree with it, then I'll do that in my practice. Right? That's an idealized version of what guidelines are meant to do, right? And then you're also very well aware, because you're a thoughtful, skeptical person, which I appreciate, that like all human endeavors, that can go completely off the rails too. Right?
Right.
So industry can sponsor a guideline-making group to make guidelines. You can get, even without that, you can get a whole bunch of profoundly conflicted individuals who take zillions of dollars from industry to make guidelines. They say that you know, everyone should get a statin, and each of them is in the pocket of various statin makers, or they say, this is the best statin. And they do that because that statin maker gave the most, I mean, that's the simplest, simple conflict of interest way that guidelines go off the rails. I know you don't need me to list others. Guess what? As people who are at the interface at the patient interface, all of the responsibility rests on us at the patient interface. You understand?
Yeah.
So that's why people like us at the patient interface, it is essential, required, and in fact it's our professional responsibility, that we have a framework to assess whether we believe these guidelines are appropriate, and that I should, only you can practice. No one else writes prescriptions for you. No one else adjusts doses. No one else counsels patients for you. Only you practice. And there are all kinds of things trying to influence your practice.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, it's up to you. So there are instruments for practitioners to use to decide if a guideline is a good guideline. The agree instrument, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is that you have had a chance to learn about these so that you can be effective. I want you to draw conclusions based on zero misconceptions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to draw conclusions based on a nuanced appreciation for the, you know, many different forces that are affecting, that ought to affect how you care for your patients.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you'll, I don't think you have very often, I don't know if it's never, but very often heard from me that you're crazy, but
no.
I want you to have no misconceptions. Like, it's a misconception, for example, to say that having a hierarchy of evidence or having a system for saying that one telescope is a more accurate instrument than another, that's just a big pack of biases, or that's arbitrary, because that's just defies the definitions of those words. I mean that. Why do you do that? Like, what instrument?
So here's what I mean. Like, I might be using the word arbitrary a little wrong, but like, say, what goes up must come down. That's not an arbitrary statement, because anybody can just go and drop something and it's not going to go up, it's going to go down. So you can take 100 different people, and they would all kind of conclude what goes up must go down. But I bet if you took a whole bunch of different experts in a different setting, they might come up with slightly different arrangement of like the utility of those tools. Like, their hierarchy might be a little bit different. It's not like a kind of a fact that you will arrive at. It's just how, isn't it just a factor of how the particular place and time?
Well, I don't know. Which example do you want to use? Is the telescope one not applicable enough? Because there are objective metrics of the performance characteristics of a telescope, right?
Let me ask you something else. Do you think it's a misconception, like, my opinion is that all quantitative data is inherently illusory?
Do I think that's a misconception? Two answers. One is, my first answer would be, you'd have to explain a ton to me about what, quote, inherently illusory, end quote, means to you. That's one answer. Another answer is that on the face of it, based on my understanding of what I imagine you mean by that, that is a misconception. Do you wear glasses?
Sometimes. I lost them.
Okay. Wow, that's should be a whole chapter. Because someone undertook a quantitative measurement process to figure out whether anything was abnormal about your vision, and if anything was, how much it was abnormal, and therefore what kind of clear-shaped object would help you to see things more clearly. Is that in the category of inherently illusory?
I don't know. But inventing glasses doesn't seem like a quantity. That's like something like it's physical
your
reality.
Your prescription is 1.25. What is non-quantitative about that for you?
Well, you might as well say you called it 25.5. It doesn't matter. That's just the number. The fact of like what it does.
Okay, what you're doing
is
either deeply... What you're doing is either being it matters what the amount of correction your eyes need for you to see that A at a fixed distance with an amount of clarity that is satisfactory to you.
Yeah.
It like the number matters.
The number
give or
comes
take
after,
5%.
What the number represents matters. Is this too...
Oh, wow.
So here's me. Here's where I'm coming from. You know Google? How you Google something so fast? Google has like the whole internet in their servers, right? And that's what they search.
A representation of the internet.
And so I feel like that's what math is. Like, to put it in numbers, you kind of enter this world of math.
Models.
But that's made up. It only exists in human minds. And it's necessarily like less than like the real world. So
yes.
Watch out when you enter that world. In that world, you can go to infinity. But in the real world, infinity, you end up arcing back. There are limits in the real world that don't exist in that quantity world.
I agree. So I totally agree with that statement. The question is not even debatable. All models are wrong. Some are useful, right? You
mm-hmm.
heard that famous quote. All models are wrong. Some are useful.
Who said that? Okay. I'm glad you brought up Descartes, by the way.
You should read his amazing book.
The Critique of Pure Reason?
Yeah.
That's what I read.
Yeah,
that's where I kept, that's the real skepticism. Yeah,
there's a ton of irony in it. Because he was in a world of total emotion-based medicine. And so, he was critiquing this appeal to first principles. And we bleed people to treat their humors, their fevers, because the blood is evil. He was saying, that's crazy. We have to stop doing that. In the time that he was writing that was reason.
Okay.
He said, stop it. We need to measure things. Do you think that I'm
no, I
mischaracterizing when? Okay, so all model, it's a statistician, it's not a famous person. Are wrong. Some are useful. It's George E.P. Box.
Ah.
He was a... He's currently... Oh, no, he died at 93. And,
E.P. Box.
He was a statistician. He worked in the area of quality control, time series analysis, design of experiments, and Bayesian influence. He's one of the great statistical minds of the 20th century. All models are wrong. Some are useful. Totally agree. So, the question is simple.
Yeah.
Like, you can say in words like, therefore, they're just an abstract concept of the universe, and therefore, and what you say after therefore is the crux.
I feel like that
what are you gonna
supports
what are you
everything
gonna
that I've been saying. Okay.
Hmm? No. You're on all models are wrong.
Well.
He was
I'm inherently
on
distrustful
all models
of, okay.
are wrong. Some are useful.
Okay.
The question is, you can say it's all just an abstract representation of the universe and it's just all invented by humans and like who would even debate that except for Christians.
I feel like if you go out there,
however,
yeah.
What are you going to do? You can sift and use the ones that to you seem useful and not use the ones that constructs that to you do not seem useful. That is the, I think, thoughtful way of approaching this, okay? Which is not, by the way, sorry to tell you, unique to you.
Okay.
That's what the entire enterprise for the last 400 or 1,000 years, especially after Descartes' work, has been about. It's about figuring out
mm-hmm.
what models are useful and what are not. Astrology was an incredibly powerful force that has shaped human freaking history. Like, the Persians and the Greeks were organizing their invasions and the timing of them around the stars and the celestial bodies and the symbolism in Mars being in this quadrant
yeah.
and what that god's thoughts and character qualities were about when it is good to wage war. Okay?
So it was useful.
People, it was used. People subsequently looked at that model and made judgments about whether that is a useful model or not. Okay? I have a feeling you're in a camp that I wouldn't have predicted, but most people nowadays conclude that the stars do not dictate their moods or events in their life. Some people believe
correlation, yeah.
Absolutely that the stars do.
Mm-hmm.
But In 2015, a tiny, tiny fraction of the population believes that. Based on everything you've told me today so far, you must be in that tiny fraction. Because, well, dude, you're painting a pretty stark picture here the more I hear you. So,
I'm critical.
So, okay, but this is perhaps the best example we've come up with yet. That astrology either does or does not represent a valuable framework for explaining the explaining human events or making decisions or predicting the future. It either does or it doesn't. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's a model. Some are useful. Is astrology useful or not useful? Most people have concluded that it is not. Okay?
Yeah.
In fact, most people have concluded that what the stars are doing and the planets actually has no effect whatsoever on human events. Or, full moon. Yeah, there's some interesting science around that, right?
Yeah.
But that came from looking at specific, like, does the full moon have more of an explainable effect on human events than Jupiter's position? Seems like it. Seems like it. But that comes from doing science. Okay? So, like, actually doing the experiments that you need to do to differentiate between things. I'm trying to get right back to where we started here. So what you do with the all models are wrong thing,
yeah,
and you say, therefore, is what matters. If you say, all models are wrong and math is just a construct of the human mind, and you just say,
so in that realm,
balderdash, okay, then how are you going to know when your freaking bus is going to arrive? Like, honestly, the world is actually not explainable by that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're not doing that, but to simply out of hand use an argument that starts with math is just a human invention, what are you going to do with that?
Well, ignore. I would differentiate, make sure that, like, it's clear when you're talking about the reality and the mathematical world. So in
math just is meant to explain the reality. It's not useful if it doesn't.
Yeah, but
reality.
But don't we agree that in the math, there's only utility. There's only whether it's useful or not. But in physical reality, there's more. There's truth. There are things that happen no matter what you think of them.
Yes.
That, right.
I love that.
So we don't mix those two worlds up,
because
the one has truth, and we can talk about what's true, but the other does not. So don't mix them up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
How do I make you live longer? How do I improve your health? Which am I going to rely on more strongly? What am I going to look to try to improve your health? The stuff that people did before Cartesian influenced experiments to figure out how to help people's infection go away?
No.
Or the stuff that came after that? Like, again, just you're so right.
Okay.
Where does truth lie? And if you believe, like this lady who gave me your business card, that she's an oracle, she's an Egyptian cat oracle, okay? If you believe that,
that's skeptical,
truth,
yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. She believes, and the people around her and her amazing website teach that that's where truth lies. The Sphinx literally talks to her, okay? That's an invaluable premise.
Yeah.
Okay? She's never going to do RCTs to evaluate the veracity of predictions made by the Sphinx. It's not in her interest to do that. I might say, and I think I'm going to see an expression on your face, but I might say that one of the things that makes science useful is that people are willing to submit themselves to it. They're willing to say, I don't know how this is going to turn out, but we have to submit ourselves to a process of finding out whether the Sphinx's predictions are accurate or not. What you say about, clinicians are just trying to prove their own presuppositions, that's totally a valid problem with science. And it's precisely the reason why we must have a finely honed set of critical appraisal skills. The response to that is not, therefore science is biased. The response to that, guidelines are bad because I disagree with, or my experience is different from this guy. If that's your response, then you're a child.
Yeah, no.
Your response is, I need some skills. I need to be able to parse truth from just someone's bias that is not arbitrary. It's actually influenced by someone buying their opinion or whatever other source of bias, right? You have to have a very fine sword to separate truth from fiction. Dismissing everything is, I guess, an option, but it leaves us nowhere. And certainly, I'll just say it simply, you can't care for patients. Like, you shouldn't even be allowed to care for them. You can't get a license if you believe, if you don't believe anything.
No.
You see what I'm saying?
No, yeah. I don't want it to seem like I'm rejecting. I'm just trying to...
You don't.
Whoa, on the reins.
Yeah, you
whoa,
don't.
Whoa, boy.
You don't. You don't seem like that. But,
okay. All right, there are... Okay, all right. Send my soul there. I have other questions. Do you want to shift gears?
Sure.
Can we talk about PharmD?
Okay.
So me and you are probably... We have talked about this in the past. Pharmacy students now... At UBC, from now and in the future, will not graduate with a Bachelor of Science, they'll graduate with a PharmD. And me and you have talked before, and I aired it on the show, and the nuances of PharmD and what it means. But say you're just a member of the public, and then you see a person, and all of a sudden, PharmD, what should they think of that? What does PharmD mean?
To a member of the public?
Yeah.
It should mean that their pharmacist is capable of interviewing them and physically assessing them, in other words, doing relevant physical assessments, including blood pressure, heart rate, palpating a joint, if that's where a complaint lies, assessing the severity of your condition, applying a tool to measure, say, if you have heart failure, like how severe is your heart failure? What class is your heart failure? If you have atrial fibrillation, how disabling is it to you? And to ascertain that you have CCS class 3 atrial fibrillation. In other words, doing comprehensive assessments of you as a patient. Also then, of course, ones that are drug-specific, like when you're already on drug therapy, to do assessments of you to ascertain whether it's working or not working, again, which is based on the patient's report, but also based on assessing, you know, your range of motion, if it's for rheumatoid arthritis, or whether you're experiencing debilitating minor, major adverse effects. They should expect that their pharmacist will know what laboratory tests to either ask the patient about, whether they've had, or to order for the patient if they're relevant to ascertaining something about their condition or about how their drug therapy is going, whether it's from an efficacy point of view or from a toxicity point of view. Then they should expect that their pharmacist has a PharmD, it means that their pharmacist will know what to do with all of that information, that they will know what that means in terms of whether the patient's drug therapy that they're already on is appropriate or not appropriate, or somewhere in between, such that a discussion and a conversation with the patient about what the issues are needs to occur, and that collectively, wherever the patient's capable or interested in having such a conversation, they can arrive at a plan, whether it's to start a drug or stop a drug or switch to a different drug or change the dose of an existing drug, for example, or several, in order to achieve the goal that patient and the physician have agreed upon.
That's all the time we have for this week, radio fans. Stay tuned for Dunkin's Donuts coming up next. That's going to be a tasty treat as always. I'm going to leave you with one more song. This is Savvy. The track is Trust the In-Between.
Fair. I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind, can make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah. For instance, I'm walking along, and I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Mm, yes. And she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.